welcome and thanks for listening to Relational Practice and Social Work Podcast. I'm Jodie.
And I'm Rose. And we are both private practice social workers who work in child protection and trauma. And we are today recording on Dharawal land, New South Wales, Australia. Please subscribe to our podcast, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, and send us any questions or comments you have
to our email, which is relationalpractice, all lowercase, all one word, 01@gmail.com. Okay. I just have to say this and I want it to be kept in. This is our third attempt at starting. Today, we're not having a good podcasting morning so far. We'll get better. All right. Let's get on to what we're going to talk about today. So this episode, we'll be talking about professionalism and what it means to us, what it looks like in our practice. And Rose has got some practice examples that we'll talk through, which will kind of help just to have the whole discussion and conversation about professionalism. But before we dive into practice, or professionalism actually, we need to clear up a comment we made in our introduction about being politically incorrect. We got some feedback about that, making a listener feel unsure about what we meant and whether she should listen to us, and it was because we said that. So we just wanted to clear up what we meant. Rose is going to do that.
So I think Jodie and I have shared language, and we have clearly taken the word politically incorrect and used it in a different context to how, I guess, globally people might think of political correctness. What Jodie and I actually meant is that there are often times in our work where we do not subscribe, follow, or swallow the groupthink or the practice of the day. So to give two real clear examples, there's often in the last year this practice language thought around safe contact with unsafe people.
In the last year?
Well, probably longer than that, you're right. Times me. But I think a lot last year when I was doing assessments or working with women, victims of domestic violence, children who had also been victims of physical or emotional or sexual abuse, I would hear professionals say, well, they can have contact with unsafe people and we can make it safe. Mm. That is an example where Jodie and I both often have lots of discussions, and we think we don't just globally subscribe to that way of thinking. And we have lots of schools of thought, I guess, around when people use that term and when they apply it so one size fits all to every situation. And I think that for us is what we mean by not being politically correct. The other example, I guess, that really springs to mind is when agencies have, you know, the need to explain to their government or their funding bodies about the finances, and that provides an impetus for the systems that we work in to masquerade, you know, targets or policies of the day. And what I think about is permanency, like a target for a permanency order for children in New South Wales. It gets masqueraded as the best interests of children and young people and families. And oftentimes it's very conflictual in our practice to think that in the state of New South Wales, this many children need to be restored home in this financial year, that they are or need to have a guardianship order made or an adoption order made. They're two big examples that I can think of straight away when we talk about being politically incorrect, where we don't subscribe to that groupthink and we do not, I guess, work under that umbrella policy, regardless of the child or the family system.
Yeah. It's the one size fits all approach that we have the problem with.
Absolutely.
Because for some families, you can make contact safe with an unsafe person. Absolutely. But not for all families.
Yeah.
That's what I have the problem with. That's the one size fits all approach. And for some families, adoption absolutely is the best order. Guardianship the best order, whatever. Permanency is parental responsibility to the minister is the best order.
Restoration is the best order.
Absolutely. I forgot about restoration. You're right. But having a one-size-fits-all blanket policy approach to something that says that you will, a direction that says that you will restore this many children in this financial year. You will do, you know, you make this many guardianship orders in this financial year. It doesn't make any sense. And it's a one size fits all approach because it's just making the practice fit the policy, which is not actually okay.
That is it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
And I think, to be very clear, we believe in equality and equity, and we strive to not, you know, further marginalize any of the marginalized groups or vulnerable people we work with. We absolutely believe and practice in a way that supports those values.
Yeah.
When we say we're not politically correct, we're not talking about, I don't even know the word for it. We're not talking about us being racist
or not
culturally inappropriate or, you know, disregarding people's intersectionality and all of the vulnerabilities that they have or challenges that they face in the systems.
Yeah.
What we're talking about is that one size fits all, regardless of that child or family and their situation.
Yeah, it is making the practice fit the policy, which actually then just fits the political agenda for the day. That's what we're against. We don't agree with that. And I think that as social workers, as any practitioners in the field of child and family in particular, you have to be questioning that policy. I think in any field, you have to be questioning any policies that direct practice in such a directive way. Because it's going to impact on what you do.
Absolutely. And I think, thank you to the listener that sent that feedback
in,
because it's been helpful for us to actually stop and think about what do we mean. But also I hope in all of you listening that now that you've heard that, you may stay tuned in and continue to tune in and listen to us.
Yeah, I think it's good. And as much as possible, we want to be clear around our definitions of things, because Rose said, you know, when we began this conversation, that we see things in a similar way. So we can sometimes fall into this trap that I'll say something and Rose will understand what I mean. And I think I forget that not everyone thinks that way.
Yeah.
So if we say something that you think, oh, I wonder what they mean about that, honestly, send us an email and ask us.
We'd be more than happy to start the next podcast clarifying, talking about it, maybe, you know, reconsidering what we said even.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, cool. That's been our corrections. You know what I actually think every time we're going to have corrections?
Probably. And that's fine.
Because we can say some stuff without, you know, never intentionally. Would I never intentionally would upset somebody? But sometimes I do upset people. So we might have some corrections that we do. But anyway, well, it's a work in progress. All right, let's move on to the topic of the day, which is around professionalism. And, God, it's such a big topic. And we've actually had lots of conversations about what we actually want to talk about, why we wanted to talk about professionalism, and where it actually fits in terms of our own practice. It's been really good for us, hasn't it?
It has.
Kind of reflecting on professionalism generally and then like drilling down to what it means for us.
I think what was really interesting too was when I went to try and find some articles and journals about professionalism, the first 10 that I skimmed because I couldn't read them were all about competency. And when I think about professionalism and when we've talked about professionalism, competency in a ticker box fashion, making the mark or being competent in a particular practice using a resource, is not what I think about when I think about professionalism. So the articles and the literature that I started to read really made me go, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
What am I thinking? Because this is not what is coming up. So I guess, what do we mean by professionalism? And we have a few ideas about what we think social work professionalism is.
Yeah.
And I guess if you think about it under the umbrella of that big word professionalism, because it is a big word and it encompasses, I think, a lot of different nuances. I think about ethical conduct.
Yeah.
Is part of professionalism and having integrity as a social worker.
Yeah.
I think in that ethical conduct, integrity, you know, sits nicely if you have a code of conduct in the practice or the field you're practicing in. I think as a private practitioner, I don't have a code of conduct that's written and that I could bring out, but I have intrinsically a code of conduct that I work towards.
And you have the overarching code of conduct from the association?
Yes.
Yeah.
But if you think about in previous jobs you've worked, you've got that, but also then that organisation ask you to sign a code of conduct.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was Cash just having a little bit of a shake. Could you try and be quiet?
Just to clarify, Cash is a dog. We have our dogs in the office with us today.
So I think, is there anything you want to say about ethical conduct, Jodie, being part of professionalism?
No. Oh, absolutely. I think it's a basic, it's fundamental to practice, is that you've practiced in a way that actually is ethical, that you actually understand what ethical practice means, and you practice in a way to do no harm. You actually practice in a way to promote empowerment at all times.
Yeah. And I think just going back to the articles I read about competence.
Yeah.
Wholeheartedly think competence is an aspect of professionalism.
Yeah. Competence meaning the actual things, like the behaviours.
The behaviours, but also the theories, the policies, the legislation.
Right.
But then how do you apply that to your client or your participant, whatever word you use to describe the people you work with?
Can we do a quick sideline on that?
Sure.
Yeah. Will it interrupt your flow?
No.
Okay. I just want to define the word, the label, the language that we use to describe the people that we work with. I always refer to the people I work with as clients. And I know that there's an issue with that word. Some people have a problem with that word. Because it kind of has this connotation about a power imbalance. I'm going to say that there's always a power imbalance. There's always a power imbalance because you're the professional and you're working with people who have vulnerability. So there's always going to be a power imbalance. When I use the word client, it's because that's the word that I used when I started. It's the comfortable language for me.
Mm.
Is that the word that you use?
It is the word I use. I also said earlier participant, and that is because I have a particular contract in my private practice and that company uses the word participant.
Yeah.
And I do struggle to call the participants of that scheme participants, and I often will say client, but in the last 18 months, again, it's that, I don't know what you'd call it, but the contract I hold, the contractors continually remind me that it's participants. That is the language they use.
Yeah.
So I sometimes will use it interchangeably, but very rarely it is client. And I think there is power in knowing that we have power and a real sense of integrity and dignity to the people we work with when we do recognize that there is a power imbalance. So calling them anything but a client wouldn't sit very comfortably with me.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I agree with that. I really like what you said. There is power in knowing that we have power. And you do have power. And to deny that you have power, to be a worker that says, it's all very equal and I work alongside the people I work with and blah, blah, blah. Of course you work alongside the people that you work with, but you're still in a position of power because you are the professional.
And you get to go home, back to your life.
That's right.
They don't get to switch off and go home to a different, that this is their entire life.
Yeah.
Oftentimes.
Yeah.
And that is the power we hold.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. But also the power is about your knowledge. And knowledge gives you power, doesn't it? And so you're supposed to bring with you this whole suite of knowledge that's actually supposed to promote positive outcomes for the people that you're working with. See, I'm always, in terms of the language, how I describe the clients I work with is that I always say that I'm working with them. Yeah.
Yep.
Stumped you.
You have. There was something, I've lost my train of thought. There was something I was going to say, but it's gone. I think it is true, though. You're working alongside them with a level of power because you have knowledge. And I think that kind of ties into the competence, what we were saying about you do need a level of competence. You need to know about the legislation you're working within, what the policies and procedures are of the organization you work in, but again, it's centering your client in that.
Yeah.
We were talking about earlier, our disclaimer.
Yeah.
Not a one size fits all approach. How does your knowledge and competence of those big policies and procedures and legislation help you make informed decisions that best benefits your client? And how do you have the competence at times to advocate when it actually doesn't meet your client's needs? So I think competence for me, when I hear that word, first thought is ticking boxes. I'm not talking about ticking boxes. This is not an evidence-based practice to meet an accreditation, to be accredited. That's not the competence I'm talking about in professionalism. I'm talking about using all of your knowledge, theoretical knowledge, practice wisdom knowledge, and the legislation or policies and procedures to make an informed decision that will help meet your client's needs. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I guess part of that confidence, I would imagine, is even before you get to that decision-making stage, is actually working alongside the client to develop the target areas, the goals, the areas of need that they see from themselves.
Well, so you don't just set the goals for them?
No, not usually. And then negotiating. I mean, I have set the goals for people because it's all about negotiation, isn't it? It's all about negotiation.
Well, it's also about your professionalism, isn't it?
But and your role, and it's about the role that you have.
Yeah.
But where possible, you want people to set their own goals because that's what actually is meaningful for them.
I do agree. I was tongue in cheek when I was saying.
You that.
I forget not everyone knows me that's listening, so that was absolute tongue in cheek. The other tenet, I guess, of professionalism is accountability. So really taking responsibility for your own actions and the decisions that you've made, whether alongside a client, with a client, for a client.
Yeah.
You need to be able to take accountability and responsibility
yeah.
for what you're doing. And you also need to make decisions that are timely for our clients.
Yeah.
It's not about making the best decision 6 months down the track.
No.
What is timely for our clients helps us, I think, maintain our professionalism.
Can I say something on that?
Yeah.
And I think the thing about accountability is that actually knowing that mistakes are okay.
Thank goodness they are, because as I said last time, and you'll hear it throughout this, I made and make a lot of mistakes.
Well, I think some workplaces, and we both work in workplaces, where if you made a mistake, it's like, you have to cover that mistake because it's all about covering your ass at all costs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we need to challenge that as workers, because mistakes are actually okay. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can only make the best decision or do the best thing that you can do on the day given the capacity you have on that day.
Yeah. And I think, and we've talked about this before, oftentimes the outcomes that, you know, are reached or you get to with families or children aren't awesome outcomes.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's the outcome that can feel like the mistake.
Yeah.
When certain decisions or the outcome is inevitable, or there was nothing else you could have done because of a whole range of things. But the actual outcome isn't necessarily a mistake, and it doesn't always highlight or show the work and effort you've gone to as a social worker to help the people we're working with.
Well, think about child protection practice. Do you know what I mean? Where a decision you make, either alongside or independent of the people you're working with, could actually change the whole family.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might be making that decision for maybe the child who is your client, but the parents might see that decision as a huge mistake.
Mm.
Agencies might see that decision as a huge mistake. You might not actually agree with that decision either, but it's a decision you've had to make because of policy or direction or something else.
Yeah.
So there's winners and there's losers. And I don't like using that language, but I think that's the clearest way to say this, that sometimes it really feels like, particularly in child protection, that someone's going to lose and someone's going to win.
And despite your competence, that can be the outcome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's really hard.
It is a hard job. And I think that's what makes defining professionalism also hard, because you can look at the outcomes of some of the families you've worked with and think, well,
yeah, what was, you that? Know, what was that even about?
Yeah. How have I helped in any way? Have I left them in a better position? Have I done it? Have I done harm?
Do you know what? Can I just know, like, one quick little story? I remember working with a really complex family years and years ago. I was a caseworker, so years and years ago. And this family was, there were lots of entrenched issues in this family, and there was generational cycles of harm, drug use, alcohol use, domestic violence, neglect for the children. So a decision was made to remove the children, and it was a really hard decision because the children, it wasn't something the children wanted, it wasn't something that the parents wanted, but it was something that had to happen because the children were actually not safe. And I remember months and months and months down the track, you know, we had court outcomes and the children were going to remain in the care of the minister. And I remember going to one of the girls, and I think she was probably about maybe 8 or 9 at the time, and she was lying on her bed in a foster carer's home and she was not very happy. And I remember telling her the outcome of court, and I just remember her looking at me and just crying. And in my mind, I was like, well, I mean, this is just a terrible situation for everybody. What did I do? Did I actually make her say, but no, I didn't make her happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always think back to that little girl.
I think over the course of the decades that you've worked, you have lots of memories, just, you know, very clear memories in some cases of clients that you've worked with.
Yeah.
And defining moments like that where you've had to then have some critical reflection,
yeah,
upon your work as a social worker. Yeah. What was I doing here?
That's right.
And I think that, in essence, is part of that competence that I'm trying to, not very articulately, explain. That is, you know, having, you do your work, you have a supervisor often, hopefully we're having these conversations in supervision, but it's that critical reflection where you finish, you know, a day's work or a piece of work, and it may not feel good,
yeah,
that you think, what have I done here? How has it impacted and all the people it impacts? But also, how does it impact you? Because if you don't consider the impact on you as a human, mm-hmm, that also says something about professionalism to me.
Yeah, true. And I think you're actually doing a really good job explaining this one.
Okay, thank you. So I think part of the competence also and the critical reflection is documenting. If we don't document our work, and we don't document it well for the clients that we're working with, then it doesn't help us critically reflect, but it also doesn't help oftentimes our clients that have experienced lots of trauma remember later on what happened at a particular point in their life, or why you made decisions you made, or who was part of the decision-making either.
We find that, don't we, private practice, because Rose and I both do therapy life story work in our private practice. And part of that intervention is going back through and reading whatever you can find about the child's journey. Starting from birth, well, actually, hopefully starting from the parents, but, you know, definitely for the child, starting from birth and getting to the point where like today. And it's hard when documentation has not been there, or it's been inconsistent, or it's been really laden with the worker's own stuff.
Yeah, that makes it very hard for that intervention, but also as a social worker reading other practitioners' work, and I know I've done it, Jodie. I know in all of my years, especially being a child protection practitioner, people will go back and read my files and think, what was she doing?
Of course, yeah.
But this is the piece about learning and knowing what you know and doing better when you know better.
Yeah.
You know, we need to be really good at documenting the decisions we make about clients and who's part of the decisions and why we've made them.
Yeah. And understanding why we document, and the why, and you may have said it already, I'm sorry if I'm repeating, but the why is because it's not your information. It's that client's information, and they need to have that information.
Absolutely.
And I just honestly, can I say this one more thing? You might not agree, but you know the thing that I hate the most right now? I actually hate it because I think it's so disgenuine, is using Is it using the child's voice? Like you're writing to the child,
yep,
and you write a file note? I think, honestly, what a complete crock of shit.
Why do you think that?
The reason I don't like it is because I don't think it's genuine. I think that if I was a child and I had been, you say, I went through foster care, I'm 18, I want my file. And if I had not had a good experience in care, particularly,
yeah.
And I read this file note that's all flowery and says, "Oh, Jody, today we went to the park and you said, isn't that a beautiful flower? And I said, that is a beautiful flower. And then we talked about your mum. You did become a little bit sad. And I thought, oh, I'm really upset that I've upset you. But we had to talk about this thing, this thing, this thing, this thing. And then we had to talk about the fact that you were in care and these conversations needed to happen." Firstly, you're supposedly writing this file note for the child, yeah? But, this happens in nearly all of them, there's a mixture between pseudo-maturity, pseudo-immaturity.
Yep.
Am I writing to a 10-year-old? Am I writing to a 2-year-old? And then I think there's a tendency to gloss over important things. Or when you're talking about something important, you automatically go back into your jargonistic language.
Yeah.
Which makes the whole file note just look ridiculous. Honestly, kids are not stupid.
Like, and they've lived it.
They've lived it. Just write the file note. Just write it.
Yeah. And for a little context to that, when Jodie and I both started in Child Protection New South Wales, you know, back in the very, very early 2000s, we would write very verbatim. I guess the practice of the day has since been called forensic practice,
yeah.
Which I'm not sure that I agree with, but that's what it's been labelled as most commonly. And the most recent practice in the last decade, I would say, has been this very, what Jodie said, the need to write to a child in your file note. And my understanding was that that started as a way to meet an accreditation need so we could prove that we were meeting the standards of care for children in New South Wales in out-of-home care. And whilst in some circumstances, I think it's really important to write letters to children that you're working with. And I think it's really important to tell a child about things that happened
mm-hmm.
when you worked with them over the course of their life. But how you write that file note and how you document it absolutely needs to be considered. How does this read in 5 years, 10 That's years, right. 15 years?
Yeah.
And am I being professional if I'm going to start a file note where I've taken a kid to a park to talk about the reasons why they're in care yeah. or the outcome of court
yeah.
and I started talking about a tree that they commented on?
Yeah, yeah. It's so disgenuine. It's so confused in terms of the messages.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I really do find that this lack of understanding about how to write in the language, because it is like I'm writing for a 5-year-old or a 2-year-old or a 10-year-old, and it changes throughout the whole file note.
Yeah. And I mean, we've both sat with adults that have come back to read their child protection yeah. histories, and that is really challenging, yeah. that work, because of the varied state of the files, the information they get, and oftentimes they've come to find a particular piece of information, and I'd say 9 times out of 10 in the direct experience that I've had, they've walked away without their answers.
Yeah. Very, very true.
But can read lovely stories about, you know, parks and see all these wonderful photos in the last 10 years. Don't know who the people are in the photos, but there's lots of photos. Mm-hmm. Or the language is very old and very judgmental,
yeah.
very blaming.
I think the other issue I have with the way file notes are written now is the purpose, I guess, of the purpose of the file notes or purpose of a file note. Let's face this. Let's kind of get into this conversation very briefly because we're a little bit off topic. The purpose of a file note is about documenting the child's journey. So if I'm documenting the child's journey and I'm documenting it in a way that's really flowery and lovely and nice and blah, 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 blah. But meanwhile, that child is actually being abused in placement, is really unhappy, is not having their needs met. And then I come back as that child as an adult and I read my file. That is just going to be so traumatizing because I know what I lived through during that period of time. And here's this person that at the time told me I can trust them and they are there for me, who couldn't pick up on what was going on for me and instead wrote this flowery piece of shit that had no recollection of actually or no reflection of what was happening for me.
Yeah. And I think what's really tricky about that is always there's behaviour that children or young people display that shows us, tells us things are not okay. So in ignoring that behaviour and writing, you know, that this amazing stuff about placement is actually not professional. You're not giving dignity and respect to your clients, and you're not acting in a professional manner. How's that promoting empowerment or demonstrating respect to our clients?
It's a very good point, Rose.
So it is, that's why I say you're on track. That is all under our umbrella of professionalism.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Good point.
And look, I even had my next point as being purposeful, and you covered it.
Oh, did I? Probably badly. I'm not having a good talking day.
Well, that's good because that's what we're here to do.
I know.
I think the other two tenets of professionalism that we consider would be our professional relationships. So how do we maintain professional relationships? What are they? And what is an appropriate boundary with a client? And does that, is that a grey area? Is it movable or is it black and white? And I think for that, the answer is it depends, and that's where you need to have supervision.
Yes.
It depends on who you're working for, who you're working with, the purpose of your work. I think absolutely the organisations that are run purely by workers that have lived experience, I think about their maintenance of professional boundaries would probably look pretty different to mine because I'm working as a private social worker.
Yeah.
So there is no one size answer to my question about what does it look like, but I think this is where your professionalism comes into play, and you need to get in with a supervisor, whether it's someone, you know, that directly supervises you or an external supervisor, and you need to have that critical reflection around what are my boundaries looking like right now?
Yeah.
How do I communicate with my clients?
Yeah, absolutely.
Written and verbally.
Yeah.
How is that? Yeah. Am I collaborating with other people?
Yeah.
That is all for me, I guess, when I think about professional relationships. What I think about, because I know I impact on the clients I work with and I impact on the systems in which they interact in.
Well, and they impact on me.
Correct.
It's that transactional relationship, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I give you this, you give me that.
Which leads to our last point perfectly, which is self-awareness.
Yeah.
If you don't understand how the work impacts you,
yeah,
your values, your biases, how you react emotionally, because how you react today emotionally to a particular situation is going to be very different to next week or next year.
Yeah.
So how it is that we are managing that, what do we do with that when we are emotional? I have cried often about the work I've done or the clients I've worked with. I've cried over the 25 years I've been in social work, welfare work, you know, a handful of times. And it's how I guess I've responded to that, how I've sought professional supervision, but also checked in with colleagues around how have you been finding me lately? Because I'm struggling with this, or this seems particularly hard today. Is it me?
Yeah.
Is it something else? Trying to get some honest feedback, not the flowery, you're doing great, it's just a hard job. Yes, it's a hard job.
Yeah.
It is a hard job, but it doesn't always, that's not the answer for all of our emotional responses all of the time.
No, because your emotions are going to influence what you put on the client in terms of how you view them at any given time.
Mm.
Do you remember that work by Anne Killen?
Yes, I do.
It was this really old piece of research. I think, was Anne Killen a social worker? She was some kind of practitioner, and it was from Norway or Sweden, somewhere like that. And I'm talking maybe, what do you reckon, 20 years ago? It was all the rage.
It was the rage.
It was all the rage.
Maybe it's 2025 right now, so maybe even, I reckon, early 2000s.
Yeah. Yeah, yep. It would have been because I was in child protection. And what her work talked about is that it's the biases and it's the skills really that you attribute to clients because of your own stuff, and then what that does to the professional relationship, but also how that impacts on your assessment. And what she was saying is that if you, in her research, she was saying what she's found is that, and I hope I'm remembering this correctly. Imagine if it's all wrong. I don't think so, because I think about Anne a lot. What she's saying is that you, if you attribute skills to a client that actually aren't there, then that actually affects the assessment you make. And you might actually be disempowering that client because you think they're more capable or they have more capacity than they actually do. And you have a tendency to attribute more skills to clients who you like.
Yes.
Or who clients who are just really passive and easy to get along with.
And you know what's super interesting about that? In New South Wales, maybe about 8 years ago, there was some research done about parents who have their children removed.
Yeah.
And it was found that you were 13 times more likely to have your child removed if you were assertive, aggressive,
yeah,
disagreed, loud.
Yeah.
So how is that a nice parallel for what Anne's talking about, the qualities that as a worker we attribute to our clients, yeah, and when they're positive,
yeah,
that I guess the overabundance of,
yeah,
capacity we attribute.
It makes perfect sense because look at foster carers. Look what happens with foster carers. If you are a foster carer who is vocal, who advocates strongly for yourself or the child, not demanding. There's a difference between being demanding and being someone who is advocating strongly in a, I guess, professional way. Let's say professional way. But if you are a foster carer who actually holds the agency to account, then you are more likely to be seen as a problem.
And look at that interesting parallel. If you're a social worker or a practitioner,
yeah,
that advocates for your clients,
yeah,
and doesn't accept the one size fits all, you're also seen as a problem and treated as a problem.
That's true. That's true.
So what about the child,
yeah,
that has very clear, you know, boundaries and their own type of advocacy for themselves, whether it be through behaviours or,
yeah,
the way they engage?
Well, you see that all the time. And we saw that in our ambiguous loss research, didn't we?
Yeah.
That, you know, children who are trying to communicate via behaviours, particularly if they're high, intensive, external behaviours, are seen as a problem, or there must be something wrong with them.
So if you think about all of those parallels, you know, child, parent,
yeah,
practitioner, agency,
yeah,
and you think about the research that we've just briefly touched on and the whole conversation we're having about professionalism,
yeah,
like that is it. To me, that tells me that there is a level of professionalism,
yeah,
because there's a critical thought, many of them, and there's a whole lot of different nuances to the way in which you're working, whether it's about, you know, respect and dignity, professional relationships, recording and documenting your work, being purposeful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting when you talk about Anne Killen too, because the practice example that I'm going to talk about,
yeah,
actually will highlight that too, I,
yeah,
think.
Cool. All right, take it away, Ross.
So just very upfront disclaimer, I'm not going to use a pseudonym. I'm going to talk about my client as a young person, and she's a female, and I'm not going to use any describing or give any distinguishing features so I can maintain her confidentiality and her family's right to privacy.
Yeah.
Yep. So I returned from my first maternity leave to a statutory child protection agency in 2015. I had my first child, and having a child was something that I had tried for many years to do, to be successful in having a child. So I remember returning to work with a whole mixed, you know, bunch of emotions. I had wanted to be a mother for a long time and I struggled with that, and I loved my work. So I get back to work and I'm given a project because I'm not seen as valuable because I'm not full-time,
yeah,
and I'm not stepping back into my substantive position because I'm not full-time. So I'm given this project work, which was to transfer a whole lot of children and young people from one team to another. They'd been stuck drifting in the system with no caseworkers and no real accountability from the agency to them. In order to transfer these children and young people, Jodie, I had to tick some boxes so they could meet the standards. So the receiving team would accept them.
Yeah.
So I got a whole lot of children, young people to work with, and one particular young person, she had been floating around on long-term care orders for a very long time, but in a child protection team, and had no caseworker for many months. So just kind of drifting, had no carers, no placement. And the purpose of my work was to get her to the next team, tick the boxes and move on. So I do believe I've always been a relational worker.
Yeah.
I do believe that I formed relationships with this particular young person. And whilst I knew and was clear, I had to tick the boxes and move her on. I also do believe I worked with her, formed a relationship, you know, established some boundaries, got to know her and what her needs were, and incorporated that into my work. One of the big factors that stopped this matter being accepted by the next team was the fact that she had had no contact with her birth mother.
Yeah.
Her birth mother had been in jail the entire duration of her time in care. So at this point, about 2.5 years. She was incarcerated about 2.5 hours away from where we were geographically. There'd been no phone contact, no letters, absolutely no contact. The young person had been informed through me that her mother was due for release in a few months, you know, 8-9 months. And we talked about contact. That young person ultimately agreed to come to the jail with me to see her mother. As long as I, you know, went with her, that was kind of her safety. And I have thought about this so many times since 2015, because I know now that a huge bias I had at the time was that I was a brand new mother and I couldn't imagine having a child in the world and having no contact with that child. So I think about, you know, all the loss, the pregnancy losses that I had, my desire to be a mother, me finally becoming a mother, and all of that, I am quite sure I wrapped up into this task of doing contact or arranging contact.
Yeah.
And whilst, yes, the legislation and the policy at the time was that birth family contact needed to occur, and yes, this young person said she didn't say, I want to see mum. She said, I will see her if you come. And I will remember forever the reason she gave is I would prefer to see her in jail where I know I am safe than walking down a road in 8 months' time and coming across her. That would be very bad for me. I had no supervision around this. I did not engage in any reflection at the time about why I was trying so hard to tick this box. And I was. I'm a very, you know, very much a perfectionist. I'm very much give me a task and I will do it. But I have thought about it so many times since and about my professionalism in doing what I did. What was the impact on that young person? Was it in her best interest? Or was I so clouded by my biases, by the policies and the legislation of the day, by the direction given to me by my manager, that I just went and did arrange this contact for this young person who hadn't seen her mother in years?
Yeah.
And was she better off for it or not?
Yeah, right. It's a hard one, isn't it?
It's hard because I don't know that it was wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it was right. I know, I absolutely know I had biases.
Yeah.
That I should have jumped into supervision and talked about before I engaged in this task. I absolutely should have even taken it to group supervision and said, hey, I'm carrying all this stuff about being a mother and there's all these emotions and there's all of this for this young person. This is everything I know about her because I did know a lot about her. This is everything I know about her mother. What do we think about? I did none of that. I documented it. I did it in a timely manner. I was respectful in the way in which I engaged her mother and the correctional facility to build a professional relationship to get a contact on a non-visiting contact day. I ticked all of those boxes about professionalism that we've talked about.
Yeah.
But I did not do the critical reflection and I did not consider my biases.
What would you do differently now?
Now, I think I know more about the theories about attachment and about trauma.
Yeah.
So I think I have a different theoretical perspective.
Yeah.
And I would be much more curious and do a much thorough assessment, a more thorough assessment about the benefits of this for this young person. And safety plan, even if the decision is still, yes, we'll have contact, I'd be doing a safety plan for her in the visit, after the visit. I would put in some wraparound supports for her. This young person was living in a motel by herself. She had no carers. She went and I dropped her home to a motel room.
Yeah.
So I would have a safety plan. I know I checked in the next day I was at work, and I know that, you know, I had another colleague ring her because I wasn't working the next day, but I would have a much more thorough safety plan about her emotional safety.
Yeah.
And I also absolutely would have had supervision about what am I bringing to this before I did it. That's what I would do now.
Yeah.
I can't answer whether or not contact was the right thing
for
this family or not, but those are the things with the experience I have now and the increased knowledge I have in different theories that I would do differently.
Yeah. I really like that example for lots of different reasons, but one of the main reasons I really like it is because it does demonstrate where you were at the time and the practice that stemmed from your own stuff clearly demonstrates that. You're probably being too hard on yourself because you tend to be too hard on yourself at times. But it also demonstrates just the growth in your knowledge and your practice because the way you would approach that now is so very different. So, so very different.
But I share it, and I share it as honestly as I can.
Yeah.
With all of the deficits in my practice, because I think that's what helps me think about professionalism, and that's the continuum of professionalism. It's not a ticker box. You don't reach it, you get to tick it and you close the book and you're done.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing, ever-changing continuum that you go through as a social worker. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. It's kind of like I guess the way that I think about professionalism is I think about what it is that you bring every day to work with you in terms of your skills, your knowledge, your attitude, your personal stuff. That's probably it. It's every day that stuff comes with you. It's like a little bag, that this invisible bag that you bring with you to work. But that bag can change every day because it has to change because you change every day because you're a person.
Yeah.
So in any given time, what is it that you bring? Oh, the other thing that's in that bag is the reason why. The reason why you have all those other things in the bag with you on that given day.
Mm.
Yeah. And then I think about professionalism as what does that then look like to the client?
Yeah.
If they could see in your bag, what would they think?
What would they think?
Would they think, this person is someone who is quite competent. I feel comfortable and I feel safe to kind of trust this person with my vulnerability. Or would they think, you know what, we're just not the right fit? Or would they run a mile?
Mm.
That's kind of what I think of when I think about professionalism. It's that bag.
It is that bag. So when people say you bring your whole self to work,
yeah,
that is what they're talking about.
It's really. And I know there's this tendency you need to like leave your own stuff at the door before you walk through the door. It's very 1990s.
And you drive home and you get to a certain street before you get to your house and you leave all your work there and then you drive the rest of the way home and you're yourself again. You remember that theory?
It's crazy. It doesn't work. And it's crazy because you can't actually separate yourself in that way. But the other thing you can't do is have work be so consuming that it overtakes you as the person, you as the individual.
Yeah.
Because that's really damaging. And it means that you actually won't last in this field because you can't last.
No.
So there has to be a happy medium, and part of professionalism as to what you've been talking about, Rose, is that you have to find a way to explore that happy medium in a professional context, which really is critical supervision.
Yes.
Yeah.
And knowing that there'll be times where there isn't a happy medium, but you need to work hard to bring a happy medium back into the balance.
Yeah, true. Absolutely. That's a really good point. So in that little bag is that stuff too.
Yeah.
Where am I sitting now on this kind of continuum of, you know, work and home and me as a person, and where am I sitting right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
I hope you all like that practice example. I'm sure there'll be a few raised eyebrows, eye rolls, but hopefully I shared it in the hope that there might be a little bit of learning, a little bit of more or a deeper understanding, I guess, about when we talk about professionalism, because I thought I was a professional then, and I would say I was professional. There are just tenets of the professionalism that I didn't get to and I didn't consider.
I mean, I'm sure, because I knew you back then, I'm sure you would have been absolutely professional. But yes, you brought all that stuff with you to work that day. Because you had to. Because you're the stuff that was going on for you personally was so big that you had to bring it with you.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. We've decided that every podcast, every episode is the one I'm searching for, which we kind of think we'll do fortnightly. We're going to try and do fortnightly. One of us is going to share a practice example in relation to the topic that we're talking about. But I think we said it in the introduction episode that we did. We want you to also email us in practice scenarios, things you're struggling with, things that we can talk about in our episodes.
And as you can all tell, we are coming to you in our episodes. We have a brief outline of what we want to talk about, and we've done the research and we've put some a lot of thought into it, but we're not reading off a script. This is us having a genuine conversation.
Yeah.
We trip up on our words, we stumble around, but we are being very raw and very honest.
Yeah.
In the way in which we're recording our podcasts.
Yeah.
Or our episodes. So you can't even get the word right.
I know. We'll say episodes. All right. Yeah, it's so true. Thank you for saying that, Rose. And so, and I hope it meets a need. Like, I hope it's useful for people.
I do too. And I'm sure not all of it's useful, and that's fine. Take from it what you will. Take from it what is useful to you, because what we do know is we practice in social contexts that we need to be able to adapt to and change with the changing context, with knowledge, skill, and professionalism.
Well, and our context always influences our professionalism.
Yeah.
Like it's not, they're not isolated concepts.
No.
Your practice context will always impact on the way that you practice.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Hope we highlighted that in today's episode.
Yeah. Fair enough. All right. Listen, thank you. Thank you so much for listening to Relational Practice, a Social Work Podcast. Make sure you hit subscribe so other social workers can find us, and tune in for next fortnight. We're going to talk about power. I mean, that'll be heaps fun. All right. Until then, stay safe.
And continue to practice relationally. The main